Future Hacker. Life. Path. Future.
Apoio Instituto Brasileiro de Ciências e Inovações.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Future Hackers. Today, we are talking to Richard Steele, an advisor to large and mid-sized companies, governments, startups, and nonprofits. He's the CEO of a venture firm and chairs a philanthropic fund. He's an alumnus of Harvard Business School, where he serves on the alumni board. And most importantly, Richard believes that business can be a force for good. Hi, Richard. Thank you so much for being here with us. How are you doing today?
Maria, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. Doing very well. I'm excited to take the time to explore some of the ideas that I wrote about in Elevated Economics with you. So I'm very intrigued with the ideas you explore here at Future Hacker, and it's a real pleasure to be here with you.
That's great. We're also so excited to have you with us here. As you just mentioned, you wrote a book that is already available for pre-order on Amazon called Elevated Economics. You mentioned to me it took you about 2 years to write it, and right before the release there was COVID, right? Which in the end just probably sped up what you already saw coming, which is a change in consumer behavior, right? So before we get into that, could you just share with us the journey that got you there?
Sure thing. So to answer your question as to my background and what got me to write the book about the future of economics, I'd say it was really born from an entire lifetime of observation. I've been fortunate enough to have lived in many countries and also to have traveled the world. And you've no doubt heard it said that from experience, not age, comes wisdom. And I'm very grateful to have had many experiences in my life. And I've also had the benefit of experiencing the world through many different perspectives. Now, whether you call what I have wisdom or not, that's up to you. But what really strikes me through all these experiences that I've had is how similar we all are. Even if it seems like the opposite is true when you read the news these days, we're definitely not as different and divided as the media would have us believe. And over the years, I've seen beautiful similarities across cultures, both in vibrant and affluent cities like London and Sydney and Hong Kong and Paris, as well as in poor rural villages in South America, Southeast Asia, or rural parts of North America, in homogeneous societies like Iceland or places with very diverse cultures too. Everywhere I've been, it really seems as though people are yearning for the same things: connection with others, safety, a better life for their children, the rule of law, a clean environment, whether they currently have it or not, freedom, opportunity to earn a living wage, good medical care, and you know, the list goes on and on. But of course, there's a lot of pain, pollution, repression, and a loss of civility and moral decision-making as well. And I think that we're at a point in our history where people, all people of the world, aren't going to take it anymore. The focus of the book is this massive change that's happening in both the investor and the consumer worlds. And as you said up top, I've run both private and public companies, worked with nonprofits, I've spent time at the White House over the years, helping to advise on economic policy and innovation policy. And through those experiences, I've seen how companies and how governments behave, what guides them, and I realize that we've really reached a tipping point. And consumers and investors are changing what they buy, how they invest, where they're willing to work, and more, they're voting with their dollars, buying products that align with their values, and shunning brands and politicians and corporations who behave badly.
Your experience is pretty impressive. You know, you just mentioned all the international experience that you have, and just that is a very mind-opening when you get to know and to live with other cultures. And so you definitely learned a lot about human behavior, and also you experiencing both sides of private and public sectors. If I can't call that wisdom, Richard, I have no idea what can be called that, right? So let's dig a little into the human behavior piece, right? So you say that companies can't ignore signs of changes in consumer behavior. So that the age of cheap, big, convenient is coming to an end. Those classics 4 P's of marketing that people at least my age learned on the university has got a fifth, even more important, which is purpose. You also talk about replacing go-to-market strategy with bring-the-market strategy. So could you please share with us this whole new meaning of consumerism and the impact on the future economy?
Thanks, Maria. Yeah, purpose is everything. I write about this in Elevated Economics. If a company has a mission and a purpose, they can elicit loyalty, even fanaticism, from their consumer base. And the go-to-market strategy is the traditional way of thinking. A go-to-market strategy is the plan for how a firm brings their product to market. A go-to-market strategy, or GTM strategy as they call it, includes plans that identify the target audience, detail a marketing and advertising plan, and then provide strategies for sales and distribution and the evaluation of competition as it arises. Having a solid GTM strategy is a tried and true business practice, but like everything else in the elevated economy, even this has started to change a little bit. So the bring the market strategy, or BTM, that I outline in Elevated Economics, it's a little bit different. So in the elevated economy, firms are subtly replacing their GTM strategy with what I call the BTM strategy. They're replacing go-to-market for bring the market. It stands for bring the market, but it really means bring the market. So while go-to-market strategies attempt to get products or services to market, BTM strategies attempt to bring the market to them. The goal of a go-to-market strategy is to make sure a product fits with the market. The goal of a BTM strategy, bring the market strategy, however, is to make sure that the market connects with the product, and more importantly, that the market, consumers, really connect with the company itself, how it does business, and why it does business. And a confluence of factors has brought us to this point. Among those factors are a lack of leadership around the world, an increasingly fraught, violent, and destructive series of natural disasters due to climate change. Also, access to information. Companies can no longer hide what they do, how they treat people, and what they stand for. You're also looking at the aging of the older generation and the massive transfer of wealth that's beginning to be passed to the next generations. And those next generations, they won't stand for things like a burning planet, spineless politicians, immoral companies that force negative externalities onto others in pursuit of profit. Just recently, it was the 58-year anniversary of Milton Friedman's thesis of shareholder primacy. This is, of course, the idea that the only responsibility of the corporation is to maximize shareholder return at any cost. Said another way, shareholder primacy is a theory in corporate governance holding that shareholder interests should be assigned first priority relative to all other corporate stakeholders. And in all my travels and when living abroad, of course, nobody wanted to be the recipient of the negative externalities of the corporation, right? Be they polluted air or water or terrible working conditions or meager pay, etc. And with the advent of the iPhone, information is ubiquitous. Companies can no longer hide their bad behaviors, and now their ESG scores, and we'll talk about ESG here in a moment, their environmental, social, and governance scores, are available for everybody to see. So how they treat their employees, their suppliers and vendors, what the makeup of their board looks like, how they're working to preserve and restore the natural environment. So look, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. And capitalism has somehow seemed to forget that over time. The few are the 1%, right? And now thankfully, even the 1% are beginning to change their tune. We're all collectively realizing that other people's interests are in our best interests as well. I hope that helps answer your question.
You know, as you talk, I just realized we have so much to talk about, right? So many interesting topics that you just brought in one answer. And you know, I just love the phrase, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. And I really hope that, you know, this is going to get even bigger by the time. And as you mentioned, with all the interconnectivity and people being able to get to know other cultures and travel and have access to quality information, to quality education, that helps because it people understand that they can actually make a difference and stand for something they believe, and the companies can't simply ignore that. Let's just go back a little about shareholders that you were just mentioning. This shift of prioritization from shareholders to stakeholders does sound great on paper, but in the end, it seems that this change really must come from above, right? Because the executive at the end is still hired and has to respond to the shareholder and the directors to the same executive and down the ladder. So as much as the investors are beginning to understand this direct impact of being a purpose-driven company, it has a positive and higher financial results. Still, how long do you see this shift from being a market advantage or just a best practice to actually a corporate obligation? And what do you think is needed for us to get there? Do you think that maybe we should have some sort of market regulations? They should be getting into play to speed this process up? Or do you think it should be more corporate driven? What's your thought about that?
Very recently, you had Climate Week in New York City. And that was a week where we saw Walmart set a goal to become a regenerative company. So to go beyond just being carbon neutral, which they also announced that they'd be carbon neutral by 2040, but they set a goal to become a regenerative company. The government of China pledged that same week to get carbon neutral by 2060. Huge, huge change. Unilever announced that they'd spend $1 billion cutting fossil fuels from their detergent brands. The moment that we're in right now is a moment of reckoning. And I think just with those few examples I just mentioned, both governments and companies, large companies, meaningful companies, are beginning to understand that this is a real change, a real paradigm shift, and that they need to meet the challenges and the obligations that they have to their shareholders, but also all of their stakeholders, vendors, suppliers. And I think that whereas it is, of course, necessary and just to return value to shareholders, you don't return value to shareholders at any cost, at the expense of somebody else. To your question, what's needed to get us there, right? To this better place. You asked about market regulation. Governments typically are good at reacting, usually reacting to a crisis or some sort of traumatic event. The problem with climate change, social justice issues, corporate governance, bad corporate behavior, is that they are simmering problems. They're not the pot that boils over and causes an immediate reaction. To stay with that metaphor, it's like the frog boiling in water. If you raise the temperature slowly, 1 degree at a time, the frog never realizes that he's in hot water until it's too late. Humanity has realized that it's in hot water. And it's about to be too late for us unless we do something about it. I write about this in Elevated Economics. The crazy, interesting, confounding, and I would say now hopeful thing about all this is that consumers have had the power this whole time. We've always had the ability to vote with our dollars, to cast winners and losers by choosing how we spend our money, where we invest our money. And this moment, right now, today, it's a moment of choice. How are you going to spend your dollars? Who are you going to bank with? What companies are you going to invest in? The beautiful thing is that now it's easier than ever.
It's really great to see those big corporations giving the example that will hopefully be followed before it turns into an actual obligation, which I actually hope it's coming soon, right? And you're just talking about that now is the time of change and how consumers now understand that they can vote with the dollars. For sure, this mix of having access to better education, having access to quality information, and being more connected to people and having this network effect when actually a company does something bad, it's really easy to spread the word. Everything, this whole scenario is helping that, right? So let's talk a little about those new generations. You already mentioned that consumer behavior is changing and how new generations are choosing differently, and that this is actually what is pushing the companies to change as well. In your book, you mentioned a movement called the Great Wealth Migration, which will be the breaking point of the elevated economy. Could we dig deeper into that, please?
A great question, Maria. Thank you. You've got this great wealth migration beginning to happen right now. This is something that BlackRock, called a tectonic shift in investor behavior. So today, the total valuation of ESG assets is around $30 trillion. So that's more than 25% of the managed assets in the entire market. A generational change will take this number even higher. This generational change will trigger a huge transfer of wealth. That's what this great wealth migration is all about. There is $68 trillion, that's trillion with a T, of wealth being transferred to future generations from previous generations, the baby boomer generations. And guess what? They consume and invest completely differently than baby boomers. In the next two decades alone, $40 trillion of that $68 trillion of wealth will be transferred from baby boomers to specifically Gen X and millennials. Now get this, only 22% of boomers express an interest in impact investing. For Gen X, that number is 31%. And for millennials, they report a massive 71% interest in investing in impact-minded corporations, willing to toe the ESG line, 71%. Gen Z is reported to take that percentage even higher. These are generations that won't stand for the world's forests burning, for sea levels rising, for racial injustice, for extraction companies foisting all of these negative externalities on the rest of the world. And they will invest and consume and spend differently and better than their parents and grandparents did. So what's interesting now is that we can financially measure those impacts. You were asking about transparency earlier. Companies that are making a positive impact on society are presenting higher returns. And many investors now looking to impact investing with environmental, social, and governance ratings at their fingertips. And those ratings are getting more visibility nowadays. But at the same time, it seems that there's a lot of conflicting data regarding those measures. You know, which providers to trust, and it's still not regulated yet. I think if you look on any financial website nowadays, there's an ESG score right there, along with all the standard financial reporting metrics, right? It's transparent. The point you raise about coming to a set of uniform standards is one that's been top of mind for us a lot in the space. Very recently, the leaders of Deloitte, PricewaterhouseCooper, Ernst & Young, and KPMG, they all announced a new reporting framework for environmental, social, and governance standards, so ESG standards. The Financial Times reported that the Ernst & Young Global CEO, Carmine DeCibio, said that the time is now for companies to broaden their engagement with stakeholders. So, I mean, this is coming from, you know, the world's largest accounting firms. ESG criteria measure a company's progress on a range of issues, right? Everything from the amount of greenhouse gas it produces to the diversity of its boardroom, as we've talked about. It was 2006 when ESG standards were first mentioned by the United Nations. And back then, there was only about $6.5 trillion in assets under management that were incorporating ESG issues. So you can see it's taken a long time, but the pace of change has been on the rise. I'd say that within 5 years, reporting for all non-micro public companies includes ESG. I think carbon will be taxed, or at least alternatives will be more heavily subsidized. Severe weather events will continue to get worse, and we'll move from this sort of do no harm stance to an active stance to replenish and restore. I'm talking about forests and oceans and things like that. Similar to the non-racist position today being challenged, right, to evolve into an active anti-racist stance. Wall Street, I think, is in for a hell of a ride, right, as this $68 trillion worth of wealth continues to get transferred to future generations. The bottom line is that the new paradigm of elevated economics, it's already here. It's already upon us.
That's great, Richard. We are going to end this episode now, but I want to repeat a phrase that is said that I really would like our listeners to comprehend. This is 71% of a whole generation will just invest in companies that will make a positive impact in the world. So this is massive, right? So this is how we are ending our first episode. Please stay tuned for the next episode with Richard Steele. He's just launching Elevated Economics, and we're just talking about that. Stay tuned.
Future Hacker. Life. Path. Future.
Apoio Instituto Brasileiro de Ciências e Inovações.